One day, scientists might add to that collection of space junk in the form of a giant orbiting lens. It's an idea that was written about a few years ago as a way to deflect sunlight away from the Earth to fight global warming. And that plan is among the dozens profiled in a new book on geoengineering. It's called Hack the Planet. Author Eli Kintish spent 3 years following the men and women who believe that the fight against climate change might require a little more than just cutting down on pollution. In fact, in some cases, they believe we may have to increase pollution. Eli Kintish joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So I suspect that the comment section on our website will light up with all kinds of accusations against you. So let's just sort of lay down a marker here. Geoengineering is not necessarily the answer to climate change, but if it works, it might be necessary in addition to doing all the other things. Is that essentially what these scientists say?
These scientists view geoengineering as a worst-case scenario response. We might face emergencies in the future which driving a Prius or putting up a windmill or putting a solar panel will not answer. If the ice sheets are melting at a catastrophic rate, if we're finding decade-long droughts are happening that we don't expect, we have to have some sort of emergency response program in place to understand what to do.
They look at it as an insurance policy, in a sense.
Exactly. You wouldn't build a house without buying insurance.
There's something called the Pinatubo option, and you actually met an atmospheric scientist who dismissed it as basically junk science initially. Today, you write about how he has become a believer. He's actually working on a project to prepare to deploy the Pinatubo option if it becomes necessary. What is that project, and who is he?
So in 1991, Mount Pinatubo erupted, spewing 10 million tons of sulfur up into the stratosphere above the weather. It's about 5,000 times more powerful than the volcano which went off in Iceland recently. So this supervolcano, its biggest effect was to cool the planet by a degree Fahrenheit.
And it did this by shielding the Earth from the sun's rays?
Right. A certain small percentage of the sun's rays were reflected away from the Earth.
Because of all these particles in the stratosphere.
Right. And one of the problems with geoengineering is the source of the problem with global warming is our greenhouse gases. And to cool the planet with something like the Pinatubo option is not getting at the real cause of the problem. You know, and so as a result, there might be these side effects.
Now, while the Pinatubo option might seem out there, there are some really out there proposals you talk about in the book. One of them is to launch a spacecraft into low Earth orbit and kind of deploy a giant sunshade, a parasol.
The scientists in the 50s and 60s in the Soviet Union had some wild ideas. I mean, they really saw themselves as completely transforming the Earth. And, you know, you find a pamphlet, which I had to go to the Library of Congress to look at, and this pamphlet shows this sort of Saturn rings above the planet, warming certain areas, altering rainfall in others. They really viewed the planet as something that could be reshaped and reformed.
And did people take the idea seriously? That you could have these giant, you know, umbrellas floating around in space, shielding the Earth from the sun?
Well, that's a kind of wild idea, and subsequent scientists thought of building such a shield on the moon and then letting it go, and it would sort of go into orbit around the Earth. But only a couple years ago, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences published a paper by a scientist who suggested putting a giant lens between the Earth and the sun, some million miles away, and that lens would send a certain small fraction of the sun's rays away from the Earth.
Is that possible? I mean, do we have the technology to do that?
That's a possibly multi-trillion dollar project.
Right.
And would probably be the largest physical thing that anyone had built on Earth by a factor of 1,000.
Now, Eli, there are several experiments that have been tried and several that are being tried. And I want to ask you about one of them. You met a scientist who dumps iron dust into the ocean. He wants to figure out if it will boost the level of plankton. I guess the idea being that more plankton would absorb more CO2. Can you tell me about him?
Right. So there are sections of the ocean that have lots of nutrients, but weirdly, no life in them. And Viktor Smetichek, who's a German oceanographer, he believes that they're missing a key nutrient, iron. And so his idea is that you could add a little of this iron and grow giant algae blooms. Now, oceanographers have tried this method in a lot of small experiments, but last year, Smetichek led a 10-week experiment with German and Indian scientists to try doing this on a much larger scale. And part of the reason for that experiment was to understand if maybe adding iron to a section of the Southern Ocean, which rings Antarctica, might offer a way to grow, as he puts it, a garden in the Southern Ocean.
So what do? They just dumped iron particles into the ocean?
They dissolve iron in water, and they send this boat around in a big sort of pinwheel going in larger and larger circles, and they create what's known as a patch of iron. And within this patch, they examine what microorganisms grow.
And did it work?
In this case, it turned out that they grew the wrong kind of algae.
Ah.
The scientists know that adding iron might grow algae. They don't know how it would work as a geoengineering option.
Eli, what about the unintended consequences? I mean, for example, dumping iron dust into the ocean might sound like a good idea, but do some of these experiments actually create pollution and environmental problems?
In the case of fertilizing the ocean to grow giant algae blooms, you might create areas that are deprived of oxygen. You might alter ecosystems in ways you don't understand. You might actually create organisms in your algae patch that put up greenhouse gases more potent than the carbon dioxide, like methane. In the case of the Pinatubo option, which is mimicking the cooling effects of volcanoes, you might damage ozone, and you might actually damage the ability of solar panels to take in energy because you're blocking direct sunlight that those solar panels need to create energy. So by doing geoengineering and removing direct sunlight from the planet system, you're actually undermining the kind of alternative energy we need to get off our fossil fuel addiction.
Hmm. What conclusion did you reach about the viability of all this research? I mean, did you come away with it thinking this is possible?
Well, we certainly know from nature that volcanic eruptions cool the planet. If you could mimic them effectively, you could cool the planet, at least at first. We know that algae growing in the ocean cools the planet by sucking in carbon dioxide. So there are these natural analogs. What we don't know is how it would work on a mass scale if we tried to mimic them year after year after year. Essentially, we don't know how dangerous geoengineering would be. And the question is, are we going to kill each other trying to find out?
That's Eli Kintish. He's a reporter for Science magazine and the author of the book Hack the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. Eli, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
For 50 years, scientists have been searching the skies for some sign that somebody is out there. They call this project SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and so far, 50 years in, there hasn't been a message, a signal, a contact, anything to be called a communication from an alien planet, with one possible exception. Here's science correspondent Robert Krulwich.
I'm going to take you back to the moment when SETI scientists thought maybe this is it, the real deal. A signal from an intelligent alien. It happened 33 years ago on August the 15th, 1977. And because science writer Michael Brooks has investigated this in great detail, he's going to help me. So where are we?
We're in Delaware, Ohio, mm-hmm. at an observatory, a radio telescope called the Big Ear.
So picture a large, curved, dish-like thing standing on a platform, an aluminum-covered platform. It's all alone in an empty Ohio field.
So you're almost at midnight. There's nobody there to listen.
Though there is a computer using a very primitive code, this computer can record any unusual noises from space. At 11:16 Eastern Daylight Savings Time,
the receiver picks up this signal,
which based on the computer data would have sounded something like this.
Basically, a growing electric pulse that then just falls away again.
And as this is going on, there is a man living nearby, just a short drive away. Where were you at 11:16 p.m.? That's just before midnight.
Sleeping.
You're asleep.
Yeah.
Jerry Amon is an astronomer.
So Jerry was one of many SETI pioneers who, you know, were listening at this stage.
I had been asked to look at the computer printout for anything that looked interesting to me.
So 3 days after the signal was received,
A technician comes along, takes the data, prints it out, and he delivered that to Jerry Amon's house.
Yeah, I got the computer printout out of the box.
And Amon sat down in the kitchen and had a look at the printout.
What Jerry was looking for was a very particular kind of signal, imagined years before by two famous physicists,
Giuseppe Cocconi and Philip Morrison,
astronomers from Cornell who'd published an article in Nature, one of the great science journals.
And what they did was they went and looked at what if you were an alien, you know, what would you broadcast? If we were looking for a signal, you know, what kind of signal should we be looking for?
Because radio signals can travel vast distances across space, they suggested we should look for a radio transmission at a frequency that has some kind of universal significance. So, for example,
the most abundant molecule in the universe, hydrogen, has a very specific resonance frequency, 1420 megahertz.
And apparently everybody, you know, science people know this, everyone.
And so if you're going to beam a signal, that would be the frequency to choose because it means something to anyone in the universe who's intelligent enough to listen.
So there's Jerry Amon now sitting at the kitchen table. And what he saw
was a very, very narrow signal.
Just like our AM and FM radio broadcasts
it's
and
narrow,
so forth.
It's narrow band?
Narrow band signals would indicate intelligence.
Why?
Because in order to create a narrow band signal, you have to have some electronics to handle that. It's not a natural phenomenon.
Well, let me ask you about the frequency. Did this signal by any chance come in near 1420 megahertz?
It turns out to be at 1420.4556, so it's
is very... Is that close? Is that...
That's close.
Is that so close that it might look like someone intended it to be there?
That could be an interpretation.
So if it's a narrow band radio signal, it's close to 1420 megahertz, it's loud, that kind of fits, doesn't it?
Yes. Sure does.
So Jerry took his pen at that moment and wrote "Wow!" exclamation point right there on the page.
Right.
Because?
Well, that's the nice thing about the word "wow." Yeah, I was astonished.
And ever since, this signal from space has been labeled the "Wow!" signal. And even a skeptic like the director of astrobiology at Columbia University, Caleb Shire.
The gloomy.
Yeah, be the gloomy.
Gloomy commentator on this.
Even Caleb says this one felt kind of like the real deal.
Yeah, I think the fact that it was part of a carefully designed, systematic survey gives you some hope that it's a real signal.
But this signal did have a problem. Because if I were an extraterrestrial and I was trying to say hello to planet Earth, it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense to just say hello one time. I mean, if something is intentional, it would be hello, pause,
yeah,
and then hello,
right.
Pause, and then hello. I mean, you do it a few times, right?
That's right.
But he looked through the rest of the printout, and there was no other signal in the printout.
None?
No, nothing.
Has there been any pulse picked up like that in the next year?
There has been absolutely nothing ever since of this particular type.
So that's the troubling part.
That's troubling.
If I put myself in his shoes, I don't envy him.
Columbia's Caleb Scharf says that scientists want confirmation when they discover something.
Absolutely. And that's key in scientific method. You want to see a repeat.
And you want to eliminate alternate possibilities, like maybe this was a military transmission or a satellite.
No.
Or signals bouncing off some orbital space debris.
No.
So for 33 years, every time SETI astronomers said, okay, we've eliminated all the other explanations, up popped an astronomer to say, well, have you considered
colliding black holes,
glitching pulsars,
black holes going burp,
gamma ray bursts,
all this kind of stuff.
Well, then how do you solve a mystery when astronomers keep handing you new clues every year? Jerry Amon, in the end, says he can't really know if he saw an alien signal because he can't eliminate all these alternative possibilities.
But they're really interesting.
Yeah, but they never end.
What do you do about that?
Yeah.
It's a very interesting problem. Like, yeah, frustration would be at some point someone's going to knock on the door and say, well, look, you're using all this time and let's stop. And I don't know if you have a really good response to that.
Well, what's your response? Do you think SETI should stop looking for aliens because it's so hard? Is that
My personal take would be, yeah, you should keep doing it.
Really? Why? You've been such a doomy, gloomy...
Well, exactly what you said. That I can't in good conscience say that you will never see something. And I know that if you did, it would be amazing.
Wouldn't you like to meet an alien?
Of course I would. Absolutely. Yeah. It would be unbelievable and incredible. But it's a long shot.
So there we are. We want the amazing part, but who knows what the costs will be. We can't stop looking, so we're really kind of
stuck.
Yeah. And that's SETI, 50 years in. The odds are next to impossible, but they're doing it anyway. Robert Krulwich, NPR News. Oh, I should add, because some of you might want to know this, a few hours after the signal hit the receiver in Delaware, Ohio, something a little odd did happen.
Good evening. Elvis Presley died today.
Elvis died just a few hours after this signal came in. I'm not saying there's any coincidence or any link between these events at all.
But we just thought you ought to know.
Are you lonesome tonight?
You can continue the search for alien life with a rare look at a baby's solar system and see the computer printout and Jerry Amon's Wow at NPR.org. Wow!
Does your mammal...
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News, wherever. You hear certain words when great actors talk about other great actors. Presence, imagination, fearlessness, range. An actor's ability to convincingly portray characters who span sometimes a wild range. A creepy serial killer in one show.
Hello, Dexter Morgan.
Loopy, lovable alien in another.
The first time I saw Mary undress, I remember thinking, God, I hope this skylight holds.
Or the big-hearted transsexual.
You like football?
Oh, yeah, I used to watch it quite a bit.
Well, you might have seen me. I was a tight end with the Philadelphia Eagles. Number 90, Robert Muldoon.
Oh, yeah.
I had a great pair of hands.
Yes, you did.
These are just some of the characters played by John Lithgow. He's also a Harvard man, composer of children's books and songs, and a gifted painter. Talk about range.
Thanks so much. It's wonderful.
I had the pleasure of introducing John Lithgow to an audience in Cleveland earlier this week at a taping of the PBS TV show Backstage With. He told us about his early days in the theater and his father, Arthur Lithgow, founding artistic director of the Great Lakes Shakespeare Festival.
My dad produced every single one of Shakespeare's plays between 1950 and 1960, and I was there, too. I was even in some of them.
Well, there were roles for kids in Shakespeare.
Oh, yes. I was one of the fairies in Midsummer Night's Dream, Mustard Seed. In fact, I played Mustard Seed in two different productions of Midsummer Night's Dream. And I was the prince in the tower in Richard III. I was the son who was killed by his father in Henry VI, Part III. I was a spear carrier and a soldier. I was a dead soldier once. I was a French soldier once. And I finally spoke a line when I was about 16 as the messenger from the envoy from France. My line was, "Ambassadors from Harry, King of England, do crave admittance to your majesty." That was my first line.
Did you bring down the house with that line?
I don't think people could quite hear me. I didn't have a very strong voice yet.
Was it hard to work for your father as an actor?
It was not really hard. He was a very easy man to work with. Working for him, I discovered that he wasn't quite the great theater manager I thought he was. He was too nice. He didn't have a strong streak of the son of a bitch, which you just have to have if you're going to run a company of actors. My father, who was a very sweet man, he always wanted to surround himself with sweet people, whether they were talented or not. And at a certain point, I lost patience with that. You know, I always counterpoised my father with Joe Papp.
Head of the public theater.
At the public theater. He was the face of American Shakespeare. You know, the New York Public Theater and the New York Shakespeare Festival. And Joe was an impossible man. See, he was mercurial and temperamental, and he could be a monster. But he was a great theater manager. He just made things happen. He wasn't even that good a director, but who cared? He hired good directors. My father was not like that at all. And God bless him for it. I mean, he was just the sweetest man you could ever meet.
Can you remember the first time you got applause on stage?
Oh, yes. I was the damsel in distress in a sort of old-time melodrama that we whipped together in about 3 hours for the final night of Boy Scout camp when I was, I think, about 12 years old outside Yellow Springs, Ohio, in a place called Camp Birch. And, you know, I wore a Boy Scout bandana and tied a towel around my middle. And
this was Boy Scout camp, so there were nobody else available to play the damsel.
It was my first cross-dressing role.
You're getting ready for Garp. That's
the first
right.
of many, yeah. For this one, I was not nominated for an Oscar. But, you know, there was the hero and the villain, and I was tied to the railroad tracks, and I was saved at the last minute by the hero, an Eagle Scout named Larry Fogg. I remember his name after all these years. It's the first time I've spoken it in about 50 years. And he hoisted me up into his arms, and he fell on his ass because I was heavier than he expected. And all those boys, that whole hillside full of Boy Scouts, they screamed and yelled and laughed. It was like manna from heaven falling on me. You know, I've always said that if you hear enough laughter and applause at a young enough age, you're doomed. You're going to be an actor.
Can you remember a couple of your early auditions, what they were like?
Oh, boy. I worked for my dad initially.
Did you have to audition for your father?
No, I did not have to audition for my father. And it was a wonderful thing. It was a great head start in the profession when I finally joined the profession. But after working for him for a year, I decided I have to move on. I have to try this on my own. I have to be in a situation where I do have to audition, where I do have to win roles and compete. And I went without working for like 2 years. It was murder. And I auditioned for soap operas and commercials. I remember auditioning for Lay's Potato Chips. And I never got the roles. I think they must have sensed my contempt. It was a sort of mutiny on the Bounty sketch where Captain Bly was torturing the crew by saying, you can only have one Lay's potato chip, and they all rise up because you can't just have one. And I was auditioning for the Mr. Christian part.
The guy who challenges the captain.
Yeah, who stands up to Captain Bly. I didn't get the role, nor did they ever make the commercial.
Well, undoubtedly, because they didn't hire you.
Yes.
Now, do you have to find something in that character that matches up with you, be it a serial killer or, for that matter, the first mate in a Lay's potato chip commercial?
Well, it's very elusive. It's a mystery. It's a kind of alchemical process. Some of it is you, and some of it is pure calculation. God knows, my most recent prominent role, the Trinity Killer on Dexter. I hope he's nothing like me. I am not a serial killer. I insist on my innocence. However, the whole thing about the Trinity Killer is that he had a mask. He was a very nice guy and a very good person, a good family man, a deacon of his church. He was a fine person to all appearances. What was terrifying about him was that you got to see this horrifying other side. Well, I'm a nice man, and I act horrific parts. People have expectations from you, and the whole fun of acting is taking expectations and completely upending them. That's how you get laughs in comedy, and that's how you scare the daylights out of people in a horror film.
Forgive me, have you ever had to play a love scene with someone you couldn't stand?
Yes. But I'm not going to tell you about it.
But you both got through it.
Well, you have to. You know, it's your job. Unfortunately, I've also played love scenes with people I've fallen in love with. And that gets you in real trouble. But I won't tell you about that either.
So when, as a father, as a loving father, when you watched your children in a theater production, could you just be a father?
Oh, I always loved taking them to what I knew would be great theater experiences. It was wonderful to take them, for example, to see Savion Glover in Bring Into Noise, Bring Into Funk. I took my daughter to see Marcel Marceau late in his life because I wanted her to have the incredible experience of seeing one man making not a sound, commanding an entire audience of 2,000 people. There is a real thrill seeing them captivated by theater the way I was captivated. Right here in Cleveland, in the year 1960, when I was 14 years old, I saw Bert Lahr play Bottom the Weaver in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh, my God.
And
Bert Lahr was a great comic, great vaudevillian, yes, who became a great classical actor.
Yeah, best known as the Cowardly Lion in Wizard of Oz. And I'll tell you a wonderful story about that. Bert Lahr's son, John Lahr, is a notable drama critic for The New Yorker. And I told him about seeing his father when I was a kid in Midsummer Night's Dream. And he said, yes, he loved playing that part. And I'll tell you why he wanted to play that role. There's a moment when Bottom draws his sword in the famous play within a play, playing Pyramus. He draws his sword. And when Bert Lahr drew his sword, his pants fell down. And it absolutely stopped the show. John Lahr told me he wanted to play Bottom the Weaver because it gave him a chance to draw his sword and have his pants fall down. And sure enough, I swear to God, I feel like it was yesterday. Amazing.
Your father has been gone a few years now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still hear his voice?
You know, I hear his voice and I see his body in myself. I'm so like him. It's genetic, of course. And, you know, the old folks who knew him, when they see me perform, they say, oh, my God, when you put your glasses on, you look just like Arthur, you know. I had a real beautiful connection with my father late in his life when he really needed to be taken care of, he and my mom. He'd had a serious operation, and he'd just given up on life, and he needed... He needed to be taken care of, but he also needed to be persuaded life is worth living. Keep fighting. And I lived with my mom and dad for a month. There is no question in my mind that was the most important month of my life because I fell in love with my parents again. You know, when I left them after that month, it was like leaving your children at summer camp, you know, on the first day of camp and saying, it's going to be all right. They hated to see me go. I mean, what a beautiful memory. It's wonderful to be able to sort of knit that together at the last moment.
John, thank you so much.
It's just great to talk to you all.
And thanks to our audience. Thanks, John Lithgow.
Thank you.
John Lithgow speaking with us at a taping of the public TV show Backstage With. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. In our times, soldiers can send emails from hell or Afghanistan and Iraq. They reach out to their families, old friends, old prom dates, and favorite teachers. Elizabeth D. Samet is a professor of English at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. She teaches classes that use literature to help cadets explore human history and human feeling, from Dante's Inferno to the Maltese Falcon. Often these conversations continue by email after her students become officers and are deployed to Mosul, Herat, and Kandahar. And then, she says, one day she realizes that her last email hasn't been answered. She fears the worst and looks for his or her name on the casualty list, and sometimes she learns the worst, that a young man or woman who she had helped sort through the challenges of life through literature have died in real life. Elizabeth Samet, who wrote the prize-winning Soldier's Heart, Reading Literature Through Peace and War at West Point, joins us from our studios in New York. Elizabeth, thanks for being back with us.
Thank you.
What do your students write to you about?
Well, depending on the most recent event, sometimes they write simply to let off steam or to reminisce. They're often concerned about what cadets are doing while they're off in Afghanistan or Iraq. Mm-hmm. Lately, unfortunately, some of my correspondence has been from friends and peers of a former student who died in Afghanistan.
This is Captain Daniel P. Witten.
Yes.
You wrote about your friendship with Captain Witten in the New Republic in March. He was in the 82nd Airborne and died along with First Class Zachary Lovejoy, who was one of his paratroopers.
When I received that news, I immediately thought of one of the lieutenants who worked for Dan, who was also a former student. Mm-hmm. And I knew that Dan had taken great care with the lieutenant, as he did with all of the soldiers he commanded. And so I reached out to this lieutenant, wrote him a note, and then also I just by coincidence happened to know some of the other soldiers who were serving with Dan in Afghanistan.
Can you tell us what they've said?
Well, the lieutenant wrote back soon after and displayed what I think is a soldier's necessary stoic response to desperate news while he was still serving, while he still had to carry on with his job. And so he replied, "Yeah, it's not good news. I really did like him, you're right. I think I maybe learned more about leadership during my brief few months serving under him than any other period of my life. It certainly was unexpected, and we all took a big gulp when we heard it all happen on the radio. We gulped for him, the company, his family, and the implications of his death upon our own situation. I think the company is going to be all right. We are trying," he signed off, "to keep busy."
Elizabeth, can you talk about Captain Witten?
Sure. He was a remarkable student, fearless intellectually, with a great sense of humor, so that when anyone ever received a correction from him or a challenge, it was always delivered in such a way that you could never take offense, and you often stopped in your tracks and thought, "Yeah, what about that? I haven't really considered that." And so I think he was a great favorite both with his teachers and with his peers.
What did you guys write about, you and Dan Witten?
We used to write about all sorts of things. We used to write about maybe the book he was reading or about the last mission he had been on, just sometimes the mundane, the everyday, and sometimes the more profound. And I got the sense that it really didn't matter. It's the idea that the lines of communication are open that was really important.
This really is a new age where soldiers go out on missions and deal with death among the people who are closest to them and come back and send an email home.
It's a remarkable sort of almost real-time experience. And I have gotten several letters written by former students who have just suffered a loss or a near miss, and it's really quite remarkable what they know they're able to deal with at the time and what they know they'll have to deal with later. I'd like to read you one.
Yeah, please.
That I received from a pilot in response to the loss of one of his fellow pilots. And he wrote, "Our troop lost one of our most experienced pilots, as well as my personal mentor and friend. He was shot in the leg, the round hit the femoral artery, while conducting a low-level recon flight. The initial shock has worn off. It's very difficult to describe the emotions that accompany that kind of loss. I suppose it's akin to losing a family member, but having experienced that as well, I think that the loss of a comrade, someone with whom you have faced danger and death only to laugh about it later, can be even more devastating. Despite this loss, everyone seems to be holding up pretty well. We've really closed our ranks and developed a new resolve to accomplish this mission and bring everyone else home."
In your conversations with some of your former students, of course, have become officers and are deployed into war zones, do you find that you sometimes carry on conversations that you might have begun 3 or 4 years ago?
Absolutely. And the remarkable thing that happens is that there can be long silences, even of months, sometimes of years. And because of email, because of that archive, you just hit reply and the conversation resumes once again, sometimes with a discussion of what's happened in the interim, sometimes just picking right up where it left off. And so that is an interesting kind of dynamic. I think the conversations during deployments are more frequent, those exchanges. Even though everyone's busier, I think there is an interesting connection to home and to sort of getting that perspective.
They feel more of a need to write, reach out?
Perhaps. Perhaps it's the strangeness of the world in which they find themselves, and perhaps it's nice to have a kind of sounding board.
It just occurred to me as the words escaped my mouth, Elizabeth, when I said feel a need to write, I I guess the implication was to write to you, but I wonder, do they feel also a need to write, to reflect within themselves in a way that writing sometimes is the best way to promote?
I think they do. I had another email from a lieutenant who had just had a near miss with an IED a few days before, and he called the IED his muse. He said, he's talking about his understanding of humanity, mm-hmm. and he said, right now, I only wish for words to describe it. Maybe someday I will have the time to sit and write something about it. My latest muse, though, was the IED a couple of days ago that almost killed me and maybe some of my soldiers. All is well, but that kind of thing sure makes you ponder.
Elizabeth, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Elizabeth Sammet, professor of English at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and author of the book Soldier's Heart, Reading Literature Through Peace and War at West Point. Stanley Cup Finals begin tonight in Chicago, and for the host Blackhawks, it's the culmination of an amazing turnaround. They have the longest Stanley Cup drought in National Hockey League history, haven't won a championship since 1961, and at one point a few years ago, ESPN ranked the Hawks as the worst franchise in sports. What? In the same town as the Cubs? NPR's David Shaper reports.
Just how bad were the Chicago Blackhawks? Ask forward Adam Burrish.
Yeah, I came to a couple games when I was in college and nobody was here. I was like, this isn't cool. This stinks. Like, nobody even comes to the games. Nobody cares about hockey here.
The then University of Wisconsin player just drafted by Chicago worried he'd be playing in front of far fewer fans than at college rinks. Though it has a storied history as one of the original six franchises in the NHL, the Blackhawks had dark days in the late 90s and most of this decade, failing to make the playoffs in 10 of 11 seasons until last year. Fans hated owner Bill Wirtz, calling him Dollar Bill for his tight-fisted ways. He often traded star players rather than pay them big salaries. Troy Murray played for Chicago in the 80s and early 90s and is now the team's radio color analyst.
The product on the ice wasn't something that the fans wanted to come and see. And there was some organizational decisions that weren't taken too well for the fan here in Chicago.
Wirtz also alienated fans by not showing home games on TV, which he believed undermined ticket sales. But fans stayed away. Even an upstart minor league team, the Chicago Wolves, often outdrew the Blackhawks. But it all started to change in the fall of 2007, when high-scoring superstars Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane started with the team, and longtime owner Bill Wirtz died and his son Rocky took over. Blackhawks defenseman Duncan Keith.
Really, once he took over, it's been a whole new world for the players and for everybody, I think, involved with the Blackhawks and who follows the Blackhawks.
Rocky Wirtz immediately put home games on TV and hired John McDonough away from the Chicago Cubs, who implemented the same kinds of fan-friendly marketing strategies that fill an old, crumbling ballpark daily with fans wanting to see a losing team. And the Blackhawks started winning, too. Within a year, the season ticket base exploded from 3,400 to 14,000, and the United Center has been sold out for close to 100 hockey games in a row. 16-year-olds Bridget and Shannon Sullivan and Samantha Delberto are part of a group of fans waiting outside the Blackhawks team parking lot at the United Center, waiting for the players to drive out after practice.
Because we want to see Patrick Kane.
All of you just want to see Patrick Kane?
And Versteeg, yes. And Toews.
Sharp. And Sharp.
Patrick Sharp.
Well, how exciting is this that they're...
Really exciting. It feels like we're like...
And with that, the three teenage girls are off and running down the street chasing a black SUV driven by one of their heartthrobs, team captain Jonathan Toews. Hockey is definitely back in Chicago. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
This is NPR News.